Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lamb today is senior reporter George Nixon. And coming up, is a little bit of inflation such a bad thing? Well, the recent rise is not great for savers, but are investors' fears just hot air? Meanwhile, the UK is set for its fastest period of economic growth since the Second World War, so is it time to invest in bounce back Britain? One thing it might not be time to invest in is Bitcoin, or is it? Don't forget, you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, inflation more than doubled last month as rising energy bills and clothing prices drove up the cost of living. It means that prices are rising at the fastest rate since the first COVID lockdown brought the economy to a screeching halt back in March last year. Now, it's feared that a steep rise in inflation could force the Bank of England to raise interest rates. So what? What's the big deal with inflation anyway? And heck, I don't even eat chocolate. Apparently that's gone up. Or play video games or anything like that. George, inflation. Why do I care? And I say this because I actually got into a bit of a Twitter contretemps with someone who was really, really caring about the rate of inflation and the CPI figure I used, not the RPI. And then we've got obviously the CPIH just to throw it. Why on earth do we care about any of this?
Firstly, Georgie, you should never, ever get into a conversation with anyone on Twitter. That's a terrible idea and a recipe for disaster. Secondly, on the more important thing, inflation. Inflation's a very intangible thing to talk about at times, but essentially what we use as the Consumer Prices Index is essentially a basket of goods that we are all used to buying. Everyone buys different things. Everyone's shopping basket looks different. But we have a nationally representative basket, which the Office for National Statistics puts together and checks the the prices of each month. Now, interestingly, a lot of the items in this basket couldn't actually be looked at last year because of the lockdown. I actually did a story about this time last year on what a bag of dog food tells us about the difficulty of calculating inflation during a pandemic, which I would advise everyone to go back and read because it actually gets into the details of how the ONS collects prices. It's a very interesting, albeit nerdy thing. So inflation and the CPI at a simple level is to what extent are prices of common goods going up or down. Previously we had anecdotal inflation. Now we have official inflation because the CPI has more than doubled to 1.5%. Now, you know, this isn't Weimar Germany, I think, to worry about too much at this stage. You know, we're still below pre-pandemic levels, but people are somewhat concerned that all the money that has been pumped into the economy over the last 12 months in the form of economic stimulus, you know, in this country it's the furlough scheme, and it's in America it's the straight money that's just been handed out to everyone, is going to lead to the economy to overheat, for prices to shoot up. But there's so many different dynamics in this, in the sense of, this jump is hardly surprising. Like, on This Is Money alone, we've reported on how everything from sheds to hot tubs to shipping containers, semiconductors, all of these things have been shooting up in price. Simon wrote this column about it.
Listen
last
to podcast
week.
Past. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. What we've had is this, what you would call like a supply side shock. It's, you know, with the lockdowns, with the pandemic, with the restrictions on working activity, on factories closing, etc., it's been very tricky to scale the production of goods in line with demand, right? Mm-hmm. So like if everyone wants computer chips for laptops, if everyone wants bikes because they're cycling, if everyone wants hot tubs because the weather was nice, factories can't compete, can't produce that stuff quickly enough. So that's why we're seeing a rise in inflation. And also it's been followed by kind of a release of excessive cash that can now actually be spent into the economy, which is increasingly reopening. So that's why we're seeing inflation. It's not really a surprise. I suppose the real concern is what happens next.
What happens next?
What happens next? Well, this is what I mean. The Bank of England, whose job it is to measure inflation and target inflation to this 2% target, doesn't really know. Its latest Monetary Policy Committee forecast is for anything from deflation of 1% all the way through to inflation of 5%. The chart is literally from like down somewhere up to up somewhere. But the central forecast, which potentially is an undershoot, like it might be underestimating inflation, thinks that inflation will peak and the CPI will peak next year at 2.3%. If that happens, not really too much to worry about. Obviously deflation is really what we don't want, which is where, because there's been so much demand sucked out of the economy, is what happened last year. you know, prices are falling, really. And I, last year, when I was working on a piece on whether we should just give everyone free money to go out and spend to help the economy bounce back, I spoke to a Harvard economist called Megan Green, who basically said, central banks know what to do about inflation. Deflation is the thing we haven't dealt with and we don't really know what to do about. We put all this money in the hope of generating some inflation, right? Because we didn't want the economy to go into reverse and see deflation. Obviously, in that sense, if inflation goes up, the traditional cure for this is hiking interest rates. But the Bank of England doesn't really forecast that either. It thinks that interest rates will only go up from where we are now, which is an all-time low, and only up to 0.3% in 2023. Right. So we're not, it's not forecasting fine mark Germany, but no one really knows.
Right. Just listening to you, it doesn't sound like a huge amount's going to change. And Simon, I know that inflation's gone up much higher in the States. It's spooked markets. But let's just take this into some sort of context. The Bank of England have a 2% target. We're at 1.5%, and George there explained it could go to 2.3%. Now, people with not even too long memories will remember the inflation figure at way higher than this. Are we just getting all a bit overexcited about really nothing? I mean, do we not expect prices to go up? I would imagine so, given a lot of businesses, I mean, if you're talking about the basket of goods, will have had a pretty bad pandemic and want to claw back some of that money somewhere.
Yes, I think that that is true. And I think that it's worth remembering that the entire point of the rate cutting and money printing that we had another major wave of after the coronavirus crisis hit was twofold. It was to deliver a stronger recovery than we would have otherwise got and to support the economy in the crash that came, but also to generate some inflation because there was concerns again about deflation. I think the major issue is that almost the entire Western world-led global financial system is dependent upon an idea that inflation will stay low and won't come back. And because that is what we saw after the financial crisis, after we saw waves of quantitative easing, you know, highly unusual experimental monetary policy, and we didn't get that wave of inflation that was forecast back then, the presumption was that we could do this again and we were safe from getting a wave of inflation. And the reason a wave of inflation is a problem is because it creates instability and it causes interest rates to suddenly have to go up. And interest rates suddenly going up in order to try and keep it under control creates further instability. Now, the crucial difference is, of course, is that this time round, a great deal of that money that has been created and put into the financial system hasn't just been put into the financial system. It's been handed directly to people, and be that in the UK in the form of furlough, in the US, they've sent people checks directly. There's talk this week of trialling universal basic income in Wales. The money's not going into the sort of the ether of the financial system in the case that it was. Some of it still is, actually. Some of the bond purchases are still pushing it into the ether of the financial system. But some of it is going from governments directly to people. And when you give people money, they quite often have a tendency to spend it. And also the impact on people's personal finances has perhaps not been as bad as was expected. Certainly the impact on the economy. The impact on the economy has been huge. It's been the greatest impact on the economy since the great freeze of many, many years ago. I can't remember the exact date, so I'm not going to put it down. But it's not been as bad, actually, as people thought it could be. I mean, basically, a lot of people were told it was illegal to leave the house for large portions of the year. Businesses have managed to sell to people better than perhaps we ever expected. People have managed to buy more stuff than perhaps we ever expected. And they've splashed out. And we've seen this phenomenon of lockdown savings. Now, not everybody's getting that. Some households will have seen their income drop substantially, some to the point where they're struggling, some just to the point where they've had maybe all one household member's income all but wiped out. I mean, that has actually happened in my household. But, you know, then you've seen the effect of people not spending money, not commuting, not going out, not going on holidays. I mean, if you don't go on a couple of holidays a year, you're literally saving thousands of pounds compared to what you would have otherwise been doing. And people are going out and spending that money. And we're seeing the stronger than expected recovery. And we've got people eager to spend. And as George explained, we've got a wave of demand meeting some struggling supply.
The greatest supply side shock probably in the history of modern globalization, for sure, I would say.
So the question is, what happens next? What do central banks do? Do they put interest rates up in order to deal with this? Do they go, right, let's nip this inflation in the bud? Or do they go, okay, well, we could nip this in the bud, but I think we can look through this. It's just going to be a temporary spike. We can allow it to run a bit hotter because, hey, I mean, we're still under the target. We're only at 1.5%, as you just said. We don't need to worry about it. But then the after effects of that further down the line kick in. But they're worried about killing off the recovery. So they're in an impossible position. But you can trace back from those super low interest rates, cheap money, belief that inflation won't return, all of the things that are going on in sort of crazy asset bubbles around the world, from the, you know, US big tech led stock market gains of, you know, some companies trading at very, very high multiples, you know, potentially riding for a fall. You can trace it to cryptocurrency. You can trace it to speculative behavior in the housing market. I mean, you join the dots all the way around. And the problem is if suddenly something happens that people are not expecting, this inflation comes back and it stays and it doesn't go down, and then central banks have to raise interest rates, you upset the apple cart quite substantially.
I read an interesting column about this from last week. There's been a lot of Simons writing about inflation recently. There's been you, Simon, and then there's been Simon French from Panmure Gordon, who basically described the UK economy at the moment as an artificial reality, which I thought was quite a good way of putting it, in the sense of we are still kind of keeping the air in the balloon through furlough, through business rate holidays, etc. I don't think we would see any interest rate rises for a while, because that stuff hasn't ended yet, because this recovery is also in part being built on the continued existence of those schemes. And we're only really going to see the state of the labor market of stuff really after all that ends, really. So I think any talk of raising interest rates, which, because of worries of killing off the what is still a nascent recovery, I think are a long, long way away yet, I would have thought.
But Simon, clearly this is impacting, we'll get to savings in a minute, but there are people clearly who are very, very concerned about this situation. This has not been a comfortable time to look at one's investments, I might suggest.
No, because they're fretting about good news. The recovery is better than we thought. We're not seeing the risk of deflation. We've got inflation instead. Central banks actually have very little in their toolkit to deal with deflation, because rates are already pretty much as low as they can go. And we're already throwing an unbelievable amount of money at the problem of low growth and deflation. But they've got loads in their armory to deal with higher inflation. They can raise interest rates. And even if they did raise interest rates, it's going to be ages before they get back to 1%. And a 1% base rate is really, really low, historically speaking. They could just stop printing money. They could, you know, maybe reverse a little bit of the printed money. And the problem relates to the fact that people are feeling flusher. They're going out there and spending money. We're perhaps even seeing major productivity gains from companies having to really look at what they were doing through the pandemic, combined with the working from home phenomenon, which actually, despite what many people thought it could potentially do, and despite all of the arguments against working from home through the years, it turns out that some of those people, and a sizable chunk to say, are more productive. You've also got the scenario where you're going to have this bounce back, because people are having this vaccine-led recovery. They're being allowed out of lockdown. They want to get out. They want to spend some money and they want to enjoy themselves. And you could get a virtuous circle as these things come together. You've seen the 5 years in 1 year effect of digital transformation, where businesses have suddenly had to take a major step forward in effectively streamlining their operations by using digital aspects. And actually, you've got more and more companies who are now taking the ability to use the best of the digital world to improve how they do things, how they sell, how they manufacture, how they source, and so on. You're seeing a potential reshoring effect where some countries are going to have more of people working, you know, in their own country closer to them, and you're going to see an economic benefit within countries from that. And you've got people who are coming back into the workforce, perhaps, who've been on furlough from the hospitality industry, who are suddenly finding there's now a staff shortage in the UK hospitality industry. So they're the people who have suffered the most over the last year in terms of employment, in terms of money, in terms of wages. And now they're coming back into the market and they've got some pricing power. They might be able to go get themselves a better job. They might be able to get a bit more money. It's tougher for the hospitality industry, but hey, the hospitality industry is in the position where maybe it could charge the customers a little bit more money because customers are willing to spend that money. You're seeing a problem that is born out of the economy doing better than people thought the economy was going to be doing. So in effect, it's quite a nice problem to have because you actually have the toolkit to deal with it if you do need to try and dampen things down. The concern is that you go back to those days of 5% plus inflation that just won't go away. You know, Alex Brummer's column this week that he wrote that talked about inflation hitting an eye-watering 7.78% back in the late 80s. You know, hit nearly 10% at one point when interest rates suddenly had to go up above, you know, 10% up to nearly 15%. There's going to be many of our readers and listeners who remember those days and this, you know, the intergenerational argument when they're saying, hey, I don't care how much you're complaining about how high house prices are, sunshine. I had to pay nearly 15% interest. But it's the worry that you go back to those bad old days and the 80s and 70s days of inflation were not happy days. So it's whether they can keep a lid on it. But yeah, quite a lot of this problem.
Are you confident we won't go back to those days?
I don't know. I doubt that we will. I think it would take... Well, I was going to say it would take economic mismanagement on a colossal scale to deliver it, but there would be some who would argue that we have seen it, economic mismanagement on a colossal scale already over the last 10 years or so, or 20 years or so. I don't know. Maybe there is a sudden turnaround. I think maybe we're just going to see higher inflation than we're used to, but I don't think we're probably going back to the kind of double-digit stuff. I think there were lessons learned and maybe the people making the decisions now, not many of them were around back in those days. You do get that phenomenon where a lot of people in business, economics, etc., weren't around working in those days in markets. But I don't think, no, I think there's lessons that have been learned, but it could happen.
I don't want to be a bit of a Scrooge, but I'm going to be, so sorry. We've got Andy Haldane predicting the economy will grow at its fastest since World War II. We've got better unemployment figures, faster growth, all those sorts of things. And apparently we've all saved £180 billion, not each, and we're all going to go out and splurge. But what if we don't, Simon? What if this doesn't come to pass? And actually, there's an article on your website that says that a lot of people are more unwilling to spend. They want to have savings because the pandemic has shown everybody the importance of having a healthy savings safety net. So actually, what if this doesn't happen? And also throw in the B word as well, Brexit.
Well, I have no doubt that people will sit on some of this extra money that they've saved. That's what people do when they save money. And the wealthier you are, the more likely you are to sit on the cash. And if you look at the figures and break it down, it's gone to the, not the super wealthy in society, but you know, the wealthier end of society. If you're struggling to make ends meet, the cruel irony of this is that you're much less likely to have saved any money, whereas if you're, the more comfortable off you are, the more likely you are to have managed to have saved it. It's certainly helped one chunk of people. There's lots of people who say they've been saving for a deposit for a home, and they've managed to save far more money over the past year than they would have done otherwise. But that money's going to go into houses, into property, and so it's just going to go into, you know, bumping up house prices effectively. It will lead to some extra spending in the consumer economy. But I think that people will still spend some of it, and they don't have to spend all of it for there to be an economic effect. They just have to spend some of it. And it is an observable phenomenon that people are splashing out on stuff. Anecdotally, and also the data shows it, people are splashing out on stuff and people are likely to continue to do so. And that will give the economy a boost. So I think that, you know, from that perspective, things are going to be slightly different. Whether it is enough to deliver the sort of escape velocity that gets us out of the low growth world that we were stuck in after the financial crisis and before the coronavirus crash hits, or whether we just get a short-term effect and then go back into that low growth world, is the million-dollar question.
George, we're going to focus on savings, spending and savings. What are your views just generally about whether you think that you splurge, George? Are you going to save? I mean, I'd expect you to do the sensible thing because you're a senior reporter for This Is Money, but, you know.
Yes, I'm currently sitting on a pot of gold like Smaug the dragon, Georgie. It's almost lockdown was split into two halves for me, because I was actually, the first half of it, was still living with my parents' house in Hertfordshire before moving out at the end of July. So, curiously, if I check back through my banking apps and for various spending things, I think I spent £16 in the whole of March, thanks to lockdown. Wow. So, yeah, precisely. Well, I mean, that's a subset of it. It's not, you know, but I take your point. In terms of, just to pick up on what Simon said, I think what we need is a kind of semi-V-shaped recovery to get us back to where we were before, recognizing that where we were before wasn't quite good enough in the first place anyway, right? Mm-hmm. So there appears to be a lot banking on investment into a green recovery. You know, retail savers are going to come and talk about. Savers are going to get the chance to buy into this through NS&I green bonds, which I think is quite a smart idea, depending on the rate. You know, this kind of we're all in this together mm-hmm. type thing, you know, tap into that patriotic duty that we've seen over the last 12 months, etc. But that, it appears to be that some of the lessons appear to have been learned from the last financial crisis, when the recovery was very slow and the government didn't really take advantage of record low borrowing rates to put some big infrastructure projects into place. I mean, talk about HS2, but you know, that's a bureaucratic quagmire. But there appears to be much more, you know, this green recovery this side of the Atlantic, the Green New Deal on the other side, you know, huge $1 trillion investments in broadband and infrastructure and stuff. You know, I think that is the way that we are going to get, you know, any kind of growth and stuff. We can't just rely on consumers to spend a way out of it, really, not least because people might not actually do that.
Mm. Indeed. Savings, we have to talk about that, don't we?
Indeed. I mean,
it's been a horrible time for savers for years. There are now no savings accounts which match or beat inflation whatsoever available to the general public. I caveat the general public because there might be some junior bits and bobs.
If you're under the age of 18, you can bust inflation for sure, but you know.
I'm confident none of us here are under 18. If you are, lucky you. But this was, I mean, just taking it into context, this was 367, I think, in February.
Precisely, yeah.
The reading was, what, 0.4%, 115 beat March's 0.7%. Thin times for savers, George. What should you be doing?
Indeed. So inflation is very simple for savers. If the inflation rate, as per the CPI, is higher than the rate on your savings account, you are losing money. It's as simple as that. So what we always advise to savers, you know, shop around, try and get the best rate you can. That still applies. You know, it just means that you will be losing less money in real terms, which isn't a particularly exciting selling point, but it is where we are. Savings rates are actually ticking up, you know, as the recovery gathers pace. Banks want more people's money, you know, to lend out to businesses and to individuals who want to spend, who want to invest. But we're not, you know, not the banks that are taking savers' money aren't big enough to push rates up dramatically. And the big banks, you know, we've talked ad nauseum about this, they don't need your money, mostly because they've already got it. You kind of have to get a little bit creative, which is something that we featured today. If you're listening to this on Friday as this goes out, as it's being recorded, we have a story up about fixed rate laddering. Now, some of our readers and listeners might know about this trick already. It's a process that simply refers to spreading a pot of savings over fixed rate bonds of varying lengths. Therefore, you get the flexibility of shorter term fixed rate bonds, and you get the added benefit of locking money away for a long period of time in exchange for a payoff. Now, this is quite hard to explain over a podcast because it's very numbery, and we have lots of helpful tables in the story, which I would advise you to go and read, which will make much more sense than the next however many minutes in which I try and explain this. However, what you can do is quite a nifty trick, which rather than putting all that money into the best 1 year fixed rate bond, which at the moment would get you £425 of interest after a year, spread it into five different bonds, the best buy bonds of 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 years, which per our calculations would earn you about £96 more interest over in the first year, because the interest is paid annually on all those bonds, right? But then what you do after that, and this is where things get really complex, is each time, so after that first year bond matures, you put it into another 5 years, and etc. And that that is how you maximize the trick. Now, there are several caveats to this. One,
apart from the fact that we all have lives, George.
That's one of them. So that's the main one. The other one is that to maximize this trick fully entails locking money away for 5 years, for 9 years in total.
Wow.
In total, right? Mm. Well, it requires 9 years worth of work. If you're putting money away for that period of time, with cash savings rates as low as they are, invest it. Consider investing it. If you don't need to touch that money, because this money will be locked away in fixed rate bonds, please consider investing it. It is a far better use of your time and capital, most likely. Now, the other, of course, is that fixed rate bonds are normally a hedge against rates falling, but if rates are rising and rates rise by a lot, which could happen potentially if the recovery goes as well as expected, and better than expected, as we've stated, and interest rates and savings rates do go up, you could be a bit caught out. Because one of the pieces of advice we've actually been giving over the last 12 months or so is the premium for locking money away for longer than 18 months / 2 years is not really there in terms of the extra interest you get for locking money away for 3, 4, or 5 years. So we advise people to mostly retain flexibility, or if they want to lock it away, lock it for up to 18 months or 24 months, really. But it is an interesting little trick, and basically what it shows, if nothing else, is with inflation what it is at the moment and savings rates what they are at the moment, how creative, relatively, savers have to get.
Yeah.
To get close to being inflation or matching inflation.
We have sort of spotted that rates on fixed rate bonds, ISAs, just tweaking up a little bit. I mean, green shoots or false dawns here, George?
I think green shoots. Yeah. I do think green shoots. There was a similar effect at the end of last summer, which we chronicled. That was obviously shifted into reverse as the pandemic raged again. This time around, the recovery is much stronger and much more concrete because of the vaccine program. I think this time is for real. And, you know, rates aren't going to be high by any means, because there's too many macroeconomic factors and savings market factors that will impede that. But they are ticking up, which is nice.
Simon, locking your money away for 9 years in savings. Ooh.
If you've got money to lock away, that's a long time to lock it away, earning not a lot of interest, is my personal theory on this. And we've discussed this in the past. If I had a sum of money that I didn't need in the short term, and I could afford to lock away, I would feel more comfortable, perhaps, if I just wanted a higher return, going for perhaps an investment trust or a fund that's more cautious and targets just a sort of inflation plus a couple of percent a year, or a investment trust, selection of investment trusts with a long history of paying out strong dividends and raising dividends, and you could get trusts that are yielding 4%, and chances are over 9 years you're going to make some money on that, more than 4% a year, I would say.
Simon, I'm going to ask you, are we going to get the Roaring Twenties? I'm going to talk a bit more about the Bounce Back Britain that you mentioned earlier, just because you've done an investing show as to whether we're going to get the Roaring Twenties, the fastest period of economic growth since the Second World War. That's 7.25%, all because we're going to spend all of our money. But as we enter the step three of the roadmap out of lockdown, how should investors be responding to this abrupt change for the good in the economy's fortunes? Something you've been looking at, Simon? What is the answer? What do we mean? We hear this about the Roaring Twenties a lot. I wasn't around then, so I don't really remember. But what happened?
I wasn't around in the Roaring Twenties either, so I don't really know either. The 1920s, okay, you had the First World War, and then you had the Spanish flu pandemic, and then you had the 1920s, which were a time of great boom. There was booming stock market, booming consumer economies. Everybody was having a great time. There was a spirit of hedonism and decadence and partying because people had such a terrible previous decade. It did end with the 1930s, though, which were not one of the world's greatest decades. And the early 1940s weren't considered a massive winner either. Caveat that quite heavily. It's just a nice term, isn't it? Basically, it's going back to this idea that we might get escape velocity, that we might lift ourselves out of the funk that the global economy has been in for a large chunk of the last 10 or more years. The question for investors is, what's going to happen now? And can you just trust in the good old stuff that you trusted in before? Now, the stuff that has done very, very well over the last 10 years has been high growth companies, companies where you are willing to pay a high price today for the promise of profits in the future, of jam tomorrow. The classic examples given of this are the FANG stocks, Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Google, although it's actually called Alphabet nowadays, and also Tesla as well. But there are other companies that people are willing to pay perhaps much, much more for. And there's a bit of a division between those companies, because actually some of them, like Facebook and Apple and Google, are actually highly profitable and not trading on that high price to earnings ratios when you look at how profitable they are, and what a steady stream of cash flow they have coming in, and the vast quantities of money that they are sat on. Others, Tesla, for example, Zoom, there's a company called DocuSign that's got a very, very high price to earnings multiple. Those are much more expensive. You're paying up now for the promise in the future. But back in the day, you were paying up now with Amazon and Apple and Facebook and things like that. Now, the question is whether, if things are going to turn around and we are going to see this strong recovery, even if it only lasts for the next 2 years, whether people are still going to be willing to pay those high prices for the promise of potential profits in the future that might not happen, or whether they are willing to instead go, well, do you know what? I'm going to allocate my cash to the companies that I can see making profits, literally right in front of my eyes, as everybody suddenly goes back to the cinema, or people suddenly get, if they ever get to travel abroad again, they get to travel abroad again, or they go down the pub and spend the money, or they all do up their homes and go down to B&Q. But I can buy those companies at multiples that are actually quite cheap, that are cheaper than the average stock market multiple. Maybe I'm only paying like 8 or 10 times price to earnings ratio. So there's this question as to whether you will see a rotation into those kind of what are judged to be value companies, because they're more beaten down, their share prices are cheaper, or just more recovery, old-fashioned kind of economy companies. I would argue that the best thing to do is to take aim at some of those that have also got good digital aspects to their business. So, you know, pick the one that does click and collect really well, or has got its website absolutely nailed for selling stuff to people, as well as being able to sell stuff to people in the shop. But I do think that you are, once you suddenly start seeing those profit figures coming in for those companies, because you are going to see those companies suddenly turning around and saying, we're making X amount, and they're going to look really good because it's going to be in comparison to a year before when they were making a much, much lower amount. And if they start delivering over and above expectations, they say, actually, we're doing better than we thought. That's when investors start buying their stocks and are probably going to go, I'll make a quick bit of money here on a company that I can see making profits in front of my eyes, rather than this company that might possibly change the world in 10 years time and make profits then, but might not do.
George?
Yeah, exactly. Just to follow up very briefly on the way in which some UK stocks have been beaten down. You see this in the FTSE 100, for example. I did a piece looking at whether Britain's unloved bank shares were worth buying into. Banks' prospects look a little bit better as the economy does. Some of the difference in price earnings is incredible. Something like Lloyds, the country's biggest bank, basically trades on a price earnings ratio of about 41, whereas something like Zoom, where obviously we're recording this podcast, has done incredibly well over the last 12 months or so, trades at about 128. it's quite incredible, this new world that we're sitting in. I think the only thing with a potential like consumer-led recovery, as we sort of said, is whether or not it's at all short-lived. So whether we'll see sort of temporary bounce backs in the share prices of, you know, B&Q, Mitchell and Butlers, the pub company, et cetera, and whether those kind of underlying fundamentals and the future growth prospects have changed and improved as a result of the last 12 months, or whether it's just people just want to buy into that temporary but short-lived bounce back? That would be my kind of open question. I don't have any answers to this, of course.
It all sounds very sensible, the way you look at shares and companies and the way something has value and, you know, and then we're about to talk about Bitcoin. Simon, what on earth has been going on with Bitcoin of late?
We had a serious crypto crash. At one point earlier this week, Bitcoin was trading down near $30,000. There was a spike down. That was literally almost momentarily. In the middle of April, it was knocking around the door of $65,000. We saw Ethereum fall a lot, and we saw a lot of the altcoins fall quite a lot as well. I think the main two to really focus on are Bitcoin and Ethereum, to be honest. And Bitcoin has sort of steadied at around about 40% below the peak in mid-April, which has caused great glee amongst the anti-crypto gang, pointing out that, you know, there are all kinds of reasons for this potentially. And that, you know, Bitcoin is not a great store of value. But, you know, the Bitcoin true believers, they're still the true believers because they believe in Bitcoin. And that is it. And I wrote my column about this week. The Bitcoin true believers and the moonshot investors, and where the differences lie and where the overlap lies and whether this is changing investing psychology. Mm-hmm. Because there's no getting away from the fact that the Bitcoin genie is out of the bottle, right? Cryptocurrency is here to stay. Now, whatever happens to it, and I don't know what's going to happen to it, it is here to stay. Yeah. And there is also no getting around the fact that people have made absolutely spectacular gains on Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. Those who bought in early have made phenomenal gains. Even those who bought in at the top of the last bubble will still be up quite substantially, you know, compared to what they might have been if they'd invested in the stock market. And the investing world has paid attention to this. There's some debate as to whether it has any real value. Is it digital gold? I mean, the thing about gold is that it does actually have a couple of thousand years worth of track history, even though it is effectively traded on sentiment very much like Bitcoin, whereas Bitcoin only has a decade, really. But maybe in 2,000 years' time, as we've said before, Bitcoin will be digital gold. There's all this argument and stuff around it, and there's a lot of people trading it. And what happened this week was we saw a lot of the hot money wiped out. So people who are trading on margin, and that is something that happens a lot in the US, where they've got spread betting or CFD accounts, they are trading leveraged. So they're maybe doing 2 times, 5 times the price. They put, you know, a couple of thousand dollars in. Now, if the price falls to the point where that couple of thousand dollars gets wiped out, which happens more quickly if you're trading on margin, if you're leveraged, then that's it. You're out. You're out of the game. The platform you're on will just automatically close your position. Now, that's very different to if you had actually bought a couple of £1,000 worth or a couple of $1,000 worth of Bitcoin, then you can just sit on it and go, well, I think it's going to go back up. So I think there's two elements going on here. There's the people trading Bitcoin because they think it's a way of making some quick money and they see the gains and they like the gains. And then, as I said, there's the Bitcoin true believers, the people for whom Bitcoin is the future, and they're just going to keep holding on to it, whatever happens. And if they see any dip like this, where there's a 40% drop, as a buying opportunity. And if they've got spare money, they will buy. What's really interesting about Bitcoin is that it's been knocking around. It's fallen to the point where it's knocking around its 200-day moving average, which is a key indicator used by traders. And it's one of those things where it doesn't necessarily mean anything's going to happen, but if it falls through it and stays down below it, then the price could keep dropping. If it bounces off it, then it could bounce back up. But to the Bitcoin true believers, that doesn't matter. They're just going to keep holding on whatever happens.
Are they true believers, or are they? And what is the behavioral economics stuff? Was it loss aversion theory or something? Are they just so knees deep in this? I can't think of a better expression. That you can't get out now. Do you know what I mean? It's like we're so committed to this. Or does it really not matter whether you're a true believer or not?
Well, I think that's where you need to divide it up. So some people will just be sitting on big losses, but a vast number of people who have invested in Bitcoin and cryptocurrency did it before the most recent boom. And even if the price has fallen 40%, they'll still be sitting on big profits. So they're not sitting on big losses and worrying about it. They're sitting on big profits. The better question is, like, if they're up 400%, why aren't they cashing out? Why aren't they going, okay, well, you know, maybe I'll take my money off the table for a while and then see if I can get back in. It's because they would want to get back in. It's not that they want to take their money off the table and put it into something else. They want to have the money in Bitcoin. And you can blame Elon Musk for tweeting about Bitcoin's dubious environmental credentials. You can talk about the issues surrounding ransomware and the criminal use of Bitcoin, which is becoming a more hotly debated topic at the moment. You can talk about China introducing cryptocurrency curbs, but effectively these are all known knowns.
Exactly. You know, this is not new.
No, this is not new. And that is why, you know, the people who are really dedicated to Bitcoin and cryptocurrency are continuing to hold on to it and continuing to buy through it. So then we go into this moonshot investor thing that I was also talking about. Now that's something where there is a similarity between these two things, but they shouldn't be confused as the same thing. The moonshot investing theory is basically buying disruptive companies that can potentially, if they get it right, they will get it unbelievably right and they will make absolutely exponential gains and they will change the future. Mm. It's the people who bought Facebook way back in the day, you know, Amazon way back in the day. It's buying into things like, you know, Lilium, this flying taxi company, buying into like the future of healthcare, Illumina, which is DNA sequencing, stuff like that. And in this country, it's most famously done by Scottish Mortgage, which we've talked about in the past, which has been phenomenally successful investment trust by backing these majorly disruptive companies. And James Anderson, the manager of Scottish Mortgage, the departing co-manager of Scottish Mortgage, wrote a very forthright fund manager's note in their annual results that were released last week, where he talked about this and he talked about the fact that investors should be more radical, that they should embrace these companies, that the old school value investing world of Warren Buffett and Ben Graham, who was Warren Buffett's mentor, is gone. And he instead urged investors to buy companies, extraordinary companies, with the characteristics that might enable extreme and compounding success that is central to investing. He added, but distraction through seeking minor opportunities in banal companies over short periods is the perennial temptation. It must be resisted. This requires conviction. The share price drawdowns will be regular and severe. 40% is common. The stock charts that look like remorseless bottom left to top right graphs are never as smooth and easy as they subsequently appear. And then he put an asterisk next to the end of that sentence. That asterisk references a paper by a professor in the United States from the University of Arizona, Henrik Bessenbinder, who wrote something called Do Stocks Outperform Treasury Bills? Which showed that over 100 years, most shares didn't make any money. No, you'd be better off just sticking your money in treasury bills, which are considered effectively risk-free. And in fact, the best performing 4% of listed companies explained the entire net gain for the US stock market since 1926, so over 100 years. And he also wrote this other paper, Extreme Stock Performers, which highlights how even the best long-term investments suffer deep short-term pain. It looked at each of the seven decades since 1950 and said even within the highly successful decade, shareholders experienced drawdowns that lasted an average of 10 months and involved an average loss of 32.5%. During the immediately preceding decade, drawdowns for these highly successful stocks lasted an average of 22 months and involved an average cumulative loss of 51.6%. So what it's saying is if you do back these companies that are the ones that change the world and really do deliver the gains, you have to suffer the big falls along the way. And to put that into context, if you look at Facebook's share price over the long term, go search up the Facebook share price, put it to max and look at it. It does look, as James Anderson said, like that share price starts at the bottom of the graph on the left and it just goes up to the top of the graph on the right. And it's a pretty remorseless rise, up and up and up it goes. And there's some little bumps along the way. And you think, well, that doesn't look that bad. It's okay, right? You had to tough that one out. Actually, that's not true. In its first year of trading on the stock market, Facebook shares lost 50% of their value. In 2018, Facebook shares lost 40% of their value. Obviously, there was then another big fall last year. And Facebook has proved to be a phenomenally good investment for people who got in early. People raise questions about it all the time, but it has proved to be a great investment. But people have had to suffer in a very short period of time a number of falls of more than 40%. And that's the argument of the moonshot investors. But where they shouldn't be confused with the true believers is the true believers are basically, they both have a willingness to tolerate high volatility and roller coaster double digit returns. But one has a commitment to investing in just one very high risk asset. The other one has a portfolio approach where they spread their risk over a number of different high risk companies. The question is, though, is whether this is changing investing psychology, because these are the two things that have delivered the biggest gains for people over recent years. And there is a cohort of investors who have come up with this stuff who think differently, maybe, to the cohort of investors who were around over the last 20 years. So will it just be a temporary thing, or will it change investing for psychology for good over the next, you know, 10, 20 years? I don't know. And I don't necessarily agree with either of these things. I just think it's very interesting.
I'm still blown away that not only do you read the asterisks, the footnotes, and then you go in to read those pieces of research. I think it's amazing, Simon. But George, I mean, Simon raised a really good point there about investing psychology. And as the youngest person in the group, we have seen some changes, particularly with young people and investing over the last year, the pandemic. Do you think this is going to change investing psychology for good?
Indeed. I'm a poor representation of my generation, if I'm honest, in that I don't get into all the kind of individual buying shares trading stuff. Part of that is like conflicts of interest with the job, etc. Part of it is I don't feel I have the time needed to make the to do the kind of research that I would feel would be necessary to actually buy into individual companies, right? However, I think it is a good thing that, like, you know, share trading, it has been more democratized. I mean, the presentation of the whole GameStop fiasco as a kind of storming of the Bastille moment for everyday investors versus the hedge funds has been somewhat overstated. But that whole aspect of, like, actually letting more people buy into companies for cheaper is fine and is good, right? That, no problem with that. I have some issues with the way this sort of thing is advertised, as I think I've mentioned on these podcasts before. But I think it is different. I think it is different. I think people do want to, you know, investing is not game playing, it's not day trading, etc. It's not it's not a play thing, you know, there's real money involved and stuff. But there does seem to have been a kind of a more of a trend towards buying and selling individual companies rather than buying and selling investment funds, or kind of just buying index funds and just sitting on them for years and years and years. It is more fun. That's the thing. So, but yeah, I don't personally dabble in it myself. I've deliberated on whether buying Bitcoin or not, but the volatility of it just scares the absolute pants off of me. I can buy the inflation hedge argument. That's the only one I really get. I don't think it has a future as a kind of payment mechanism or as a replacement for what they call fiat currency. I don't necessarily buy the future use case arguments. The only one I really see is what people say is the kind of digital gold argument, of it retains its value against inflation, right? I can buy that, and that's what, you know, professional investors have bought. Mm-hmm. You know, that investment trust Ruffer kind of bought it for that reason, I think, Simon. Is that right?
It did. It bought, yeah. Well, it said that there was going to be increasing institutional adoption of Bitcoin over the years. So it's worth noting that Ruffer bought a load of Bitcoin and then made a load of money on it and then sold it.
Yeah, no, for sure. But that argument I can get behind, but the volatility just scares me too much. Like, anything where if I'd owned one Bitcoin, I would have lost like $15,000 off of it in the space of, like, that can happen in like 3 days. Like, that's just terrifying.
I think the important thing to note is diversification is key. Mm-hmm. However you're investing, diversification is key. And I think that's the problem with a lot of cryptocurrency investing, is if 5% of your portfolio is cryptocurrency, fine. But just know that you're taking a high risk, high volatility investment with 5% of your portfolio. If 95% of your portfolio is cryptocurrency, you've got a problem, sunshine, because it's all going to rise and fall together, and you could very easily lose a large amount of money in a very short space of time. And you need to be really happy that that could potentially happen. If you're investing in moonshot shares, absolutely fine, but you need to hold another piece of investing research goes back many years, shows you need to hold about 15 to 20 companies at least to have the level of diversification that is ideal. And they need to be 15 to 20 companies that don't all do the same thing and don't all move in tandem. And the risk is that with some of these moonshot investment firms is that they're all the same trade, effectively. They might do very different things. One might deliver food to people. One might be the future of healthcare. One might be making electric cars. One might be making flying taxis. One might be selling people stuff. But if they all move, they all go up together and they all go down together and they all go up together and they all go down together, then you're not properly diversified. You know, that might mean that when everything's going up like crazy, you make absolutely tons of money, but there will come a day when stuff will fall, and that's when you need the diversification.
I wish the listeners could see George, but like a little schoolboy, every time you want to speak, you put your hand up. It's so sweet. Yes, George?
Don't want to interrupt. I'm not far off being a little schoolboy, George, as you know. The only last point I would make on that kind of stuff is beware the hype. I remember when there was a big trend of SoftBank vision fund backed companies, the Ubers, the DoorDashes, the Wags, which was a dog walk, which was an Uber for dog walkers. All this stuff, these multi-billion dollar venture capital backed companies that had never made any money, but all exist in the same space, were going to remake the consumer economy. And they just haven't. I would always, that's the caveat I would always go back to.
All right, then, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. You can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast. Join in the debate and read comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.